Check Podcasts.
The Center for Ocean Applied Sustainable Technologies, or COAST, welcomes you to COAST Talks, showcasing the people, ideas, businesses, and communities driving innovation in Pacific Canada's sustainable blue economy. Brought to you by the South Island Prosperity Partnership.
Welcome to the COAST Talks podcast, a deep dive into the innovations driving BC's blue economy. My name is Jason Goldsworthy and I'm the Executive Director of COAST and your host today. COAST is the Centre for Ocean Applied Sustainable Technologies and we are Pacific Canada's hub for the blue economy, supporting members' research, startup and scale up sustainable ocean innovation. On today's episode, we explore the technology powering Norwegian salmon producer Aqua Future. And we are lucky to have the Canadian Managing Director, Dean Trethewey, joining us. Welcome, Dean, and thank you for sharing your time.
Nice to be with you today, Jason. Thank you.
Dean, Aqua Future is promoting Eco Salmon. I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about that product and also a little bit about the history of the company as well.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it's been a very interesting dive into this company as I'm one of the newer members. But as I stick my head up, I've been in aquaculture growing salmon on the coast here for over 30 years. So as I started to obviously joined Aqua Future as their managing director, I ask all the tough questions, get right in there. And it's a very interesting company. They've sort of been quiet in the background, just really perfecting their technology, keeping their heads down because like so many other companies that deal in closed barrier technology, this is a very different company because they also are their own farming company and they grow their own salmon. So they don't sell the technology. They just use it, perfect it to grow a very, very good product, which they obviously call the Eco Salmon. They started off over 10 years ago, trialing different technologies, trying to work with closed containment and doing it on a smaller scale. It's sort of how Norway encourages new license and the ability to grow aquaculture. But once, of course, they were able to have the breakthrough of being able to be successful in growing a salmon all the way from smolt all the way to harvest size at 5 kilos, new owners took over the company and decided to take it on to full production. So now in the town of Brønnøysund, which is located right in the middle of Norway, if you drew a line right down the center of a very long coast, you'd find the Aqua Future's home and head office. And they have three full farms there, all in full-scale production. And so to date, they've grown over 40,000 tons of harvestable salmon.
It's called Eco Salmon. What makes it Eco Salmon?
Yeah, it's you know, something that they're very proud of. And you know, it's taken many years to develop in this technology. But one of the very important aspects that they focused on, of course, because there was a lot of challenges in Norway around sea lice and the sea lice management. And so what they set out to do is develop a preventative technology that allows them to avoid the whole challenge of having to do treatments. And so since they've been up and running in production, they've had no sea lice on any of the salmon, which is great considering where the challenge is and where the public perception is on the challenge of sea lice right now.
And I'd like to come back later a bit on some of those challenges, but I mean, this is pretty cool technology. It's a pretty interesting process. What impact could it really have if it's taken on board and grown out and scaled out?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity, and especially when you look at an industry, you know, not only in Canada, but globally, and it's very innovative, and it's still compared to other industries, it's still a very new industry. So, you know, I think even in the time that I've, you know, grown salmon, I can say that I have never grown salmon the same way twice. And it in itself, it's a very innovative industry. And it's great because farmers, like anywhere, even farmers on land, one of the things they love to do is they love to tackle their problems and come up with engineering solutions. And a farmer, you know, is always inventing newer and better ways to do it and always push towards a more sustainable product. Where Aqua Future's been is looking at this sort of full circular economy. So not only, you know, are we finding ways by using deeper water where sea lice don't live or thrive, we're able to utilize that water inside of the closed barrier system, which prevents us from having to do the treatments. Now, of course, the water is then captured through what we have as a hydraulic cylinder cone in the bottom, and that regulates the flow and the hydrology of the water. Because once you get into this closed system, now you have to take over the management of it, which means the oxygen, the regulation, the flow, and everything else, which is great because on that, we're able to then screen the material out of the bottom and recapture that as well. And in Norway, we use that material in several different outputs. One of them is for biofuels. So if you go to Bergen and get on a bus downtown, it's very likely that it's come from part of our product, which is and generates biofuels. We also use it for soil reneutrification in other countries like Vietnam. And this is where I think Canada poses an excellent opportunity because we have so many neighboring provinces that are very, very into farming. So if we can keep this symbiotic relationship between BC and Saskatchewan, where we have this full circular economy, I think it's a great opportunity.
And I mean, the circular economy is part of where we're trying to take, and the blue economy is kind of, we're trying to look for those opportunities in those areas where we can connect the dots. You also mentioned about sustainability, and I just want to come back quickly on that, because a lot of what Act for Future is doing is very sustainable in the way that's building out their technology. Is there any other things in, we know that, you know, fish farming can be energy intensive, that sort of stuff. What's Act for Future looking at in terms of sustainability?
Yeah, and it's, there are so many, and one of the other, like it's good to, you know, drill into the right now when we look at renewable energy, because of course once we do the closed barrier systems where you have to have pumps and oxygen and everything else, but when we look at the renewable energy in BC, that's the BC Hydro, it is power significant, so it does take a fair bit of energy to use this, but in terms of the CO2 equivalent per kilogram, I mean, salmon farming is already the lowest compared to all other protein farmers in the world. But Aquafuture is even lower because we have such high survival and such great growth that we literally are the lowest carbon footprint in all of protein farming in the world, which is, I think, another great success story.
You know, something that probably not a lot of people recognize or understand as well. And even me personally, I mean, it's a fantastic, you know, promotion of perspective and get that awareness out there. You mentioned Act for Future, based in Norway, based in Europe. You're the Canadian managing director. There's opportunities here. Why is Act for Future investing into Canada, and what do you see the growth there?
We certainly are, you know, there seems to be a lot of opportunity. I mean, when you know, there's a lot of opportunity for all different types of aquaculture in Canada. You look at Canada's coastline, you know, BC in particular, I think we have one of the longest coastlines in the world. You know, when you look at aquaculture, and right now only 3% of the food actually comes from the marine and freshwater sources. So given that it's 71% of the planet, you start looking at where these opportunities are. And of course, BC has a great temperature profile for this. One of the other advantages when you start looking at the closed barrier systems is because we draw from depth, that actually opens up more of the lateral availability of farming. So we can even look a little further north and a little further south than your open net farming. Of course, with the changing environment right now, and you see in a lot of different areas where the surface temperatures have gotten not favorable, you know, once you get above that 16, 17 degrees, then it's sort of have an adverse effect for growing salmon. But the deeper, cooler water is definitely preferred. The fact that we can now contain that in the areas that we're growing our salmon opens up more coast for us to farm.
So it does seem Canada and BC is a natural fit for developing this technology and potentially marketing it.
Absolutely. I think, and when you travel around BC and you look at some of these small coastal communities, you know, they've had their years of the big mining, the logging, of course, the commercial fishing, which was in its heydays, the glories, which really helped build a lot of these small coastal communities. But now there's a shift. I think there's a perfect change that can be, if it's supported, a good opportunity for all these small communities to continue to grow in the way that they have by bringing in and adopting aquaculture and the various ways to do it.
So that's the positives. I'm going to just the elephant in the room about there has been some misconceptions about fish farming around the world. You talked about the closed system, which I think is a big step, but what are the big challenges with scaling up operations like this, especially those that are much more sustainable, more innovative, but perhaps have been hurt by some of the previous issues?
You know, yeah, and it's a good point to touch on, Jason, because it is, you know, we have to be cognizant of where we've been, and as we go forward, make sure that we look at some of the things that we could have done better in the past. And you know, when you look, 30 years ago, there's been a lot of improvements in the technology for aquaculture in all its various forms. When I think about where we are today and what we need to do to keep moving forward is we need to keep a good public awareness and communication. You know, that social license is so important. And it's not an easy subject because you're getting into, like any farming today, it can sound scary when you're talking about the different technologies. And of course that means we just have to do a better job of finding a way to communicate that clearly. I think if you could look at, some of the, I think things that I could be help the industry in Canada in general is I think where we talk about this opportunity of blue economy, it's such a great opportunity, but in terms of who's promoting it in government, that I think creates a bit of a challenge. And right now, aquaculture's, it's regulated by DFO on the BC coast. And I think a lot of people aren't always comfortable with the government department being your promoter and your regulator. And so one of the things I think would be a positive change is that we actually create a different department within the government that actually gets behind innovative solutions in rural coastal communities that helps advance indigenous relationships. And aquaculture is a great opportunity to do that. But it can't be seen both as the promoter and the regulator. Whereas right now, if anybody from DFO starts to promote aquaculture, I think people get frustrated by that. And they're like, you're supposed to be policing it, not promoting it. So I think that's a big one. I think that's a huge one. And because you start to run into, like we're talking about new innovation, you're going into, you're going into uncharted areas. And we can see this in all kinds of different sectors, one being the energy sector. I think there's even an example on the East Coast of Canada now where a massive successful project found a way to generate, energy based on ocean currents, but it was basically shut down because they couldn't get DFO to find a way to regulate it. And so we run into this time and time as you get into these sort of new areas of opportunity. There aren't the systems in place already. So you have to, as on the tip of the spear, be the forefront. And again, that makes it difficult if you don't have a champion in government to help advance you through those ways.
You talked briefly in there about Indigenous communities, and you mentioned earlier that, communities around have been built out around timber mills. And is there an opportunity here for communities to get right behind this and see a new economy and industry born out of this, especially more sustainable aquaculture?
Yeah, I strongly believe that. I think that right now you see it on this real tipping point where the communities, because of all the political activity lately, have sort of gotten a lot louder getting behind the industry. I'm up in Port Hardy, British Columbia right now, and it's a community that I'd say most people up here are very thankful for having aquaculture. In the recent months and last few years, they've spoken out in favor of aquaculture. You know, the mayor, council, they get behind it because they can see the economic opportunity. I mean, when you look at aquaculture in Canada, it's $5 billion in economic activity. That's no small number. $2 billion in GDP. You think about it's 20,000 full-time jobs. And we're just, I think, at a great opportunity for expanding and growing on that. And we strongly believe at AquaFuture that using the closed barrier system as a tool to do that, that will allow us to gain more trust with the public and allow the industry as a whole to grow, because we need both.
And there's the flow-on activities as well. I mean, we've talked in the past about there's other supporting technologies. We talked about, you know, renewable energies as well, but there's all these other components that have to go to build this sort of swell of momentum regarding, excuse the puns, we get into a lot of those in these sessions, that swell of momentum around developing new technologies in that blue economy. And I assume Aquafuture is in the same boat, that you're going to need other supporting technologies.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, when you look at over the years, a lot of the things that, you know, in this industry that we've had to really gain a better understanding of is the changing environment. I think about different projects where we've looked at environmental monitoring, and it poses itself as a great opportunity because you think about all of these aquaculture sites, you know, along the coast, on both coasts of Canada, and they become these huge data platforms for really getting real-time, you know, environmental data that we can help to understand. We talk about changing environment, but let's capture it and really dive deeper into that. And it's always very difficult to do, you know, scientifically, because you might be able to send a probe out or an ROV or do a one-off science experiment. But when you have these locations scattered all up and down the coast, this is this ability to bring in real-time data. So that's one example where now that springs a sort of a platform for many other industries to collect that data, use that data, and then it helps to drive their business and decisions into something more solid and sustainable themselves. So, you know, we need to partner with good data scientists, the ROV, the ability for doing all of that capture, and then how we can interpret that data for future uses.
So I'd like to get back to Aquafuture so we can learn a little bit more. So what stage of the development is Aquafuture at in Canada right now?
Right now, we are in discussions with a lot of First Nation communities. As anybody who lives in BC, we understand the importance of UNDRIP. And, you know, for the nations to, you know, have the right to choose aquaculture in their territories that they have the stewardship. And, you know, obviously the important thing is that that's done correctly. And in the beginning, we want to make sure that we're building those relationships in a positive manner and really understanding, because you can't just say First Nations, as that's one thing in BC. There's so many different nations and they all have their own unique culture. And it's about really understanding that. So right now we're in some very good discussions with a lot of the First Nation communities and hearing, you know, their need and take on how they'd like to see aquaculture in their territories. From that point, it's important that we also do the environmental monitoring. You know, you asked earlier some of what are the challenges, and, you know, if it's just aquaculture in open net, you're looking for a great site. When it comes to doing closed barrier systems, then of course we're looking at, you know, having to be close to the hydro grid and have good water quality. So that that narrows down the scope of selected available sites. But we feel that we've got some good locations to start with some good relationships to build on, and ready for the next environmental monitoring and starting the application process with the government.
What's sort of the key barriers stopping you? That you talked about building relationships, which is fantastic, with the Indigenous communities and local communities, I assume, the environmental. But what are the key things that you kind of need to sort of progress in an accelerated fashion?
You know, the hydro one is a challenge in BC. And I think, you know, a lot of developers, even in housing, are talking about this this barrier right now. You know, you would think in some areas where you can see there's good infrastructure, you think that that's a good spot to start. And we've had estimates from BC Hydro that in order to hook up in those areas we've looked at, they're about $30 million for the BC Hydro portion of that. So, you know, as much as we would love to see those areas develop, it's going to need that BC Hydro starts to catch up a little bit with hydro needs and all developers. You know, it could be that a developer in the city is built a condo and the neighboring right across the street developer that wants to build the same condo is on the hook for all the infrastructure upgrades at that point. So in a lot of areas in BC, some of them have hit sort of max capacity of what they have until they do a big investment to upgrade the capacity to the next levels and allow other developers and aquaculture industries to be able to come into those areas. But that's not to say all areas. There are some areas that still have this opportunity, and those are the areas that we're focusing on right now.
And with all the talk regarding you know, decentralized grids, and you know, there's opportunities for, you know, joint developments out of that infrastructure, I presume.
Absolutely. You know, and there's even smaller scale projects. You know, I know First Nations have been looking at a lot more in the interior side of BC as well, but it could be that, you know, they're going to have to, we'll all have to work together to develop what the capacity could be in terms of hydro needs and make it custom to where and what territories we're looking in.
So knocking down a few of those barriers, because, you know, that's easy for us when we're just sitting here talking, that we can clear all those barriers out of your way. What's the vision for ACFA Future in British Columbia in the next 5 to 10 years?
We'd love to get a few farms up and running, you know, in the next couple of years, and then really solidify that design and those relationships so that they're very strong. And then in a very pragmatic way, build on that strength. You know, we don't want to just go in fast and build it up and then it collapses. We want to make sure that it's a strong growth. And, you know, I always say every solution creates two new problems. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're able to go at that at a pace that we're able to be strong and successful. You know, right now with our farms in Norway, we see consistently production year over year, 95 or better survival. Mm-hmm. And that's way above the, you know, the traditional farming practices. So it shows you that, you know, having a good handle on your water quality can produce very good results. With that is also we achieve a 95% or higher superior rate. A superior rate is sort of what you use to measure the quality of salmon. So this falls in one of the highest categories. And again, we don't want to compromise that. We think it's really important that we can keep with the, you know, our zero threshold, our amazing survival, low CO2, you know, a great superior rate, because all of that ends up being more yield to produce, which helps us with our cost of this technology. Right now, we are right on par with the average cost of open net farming, but that's a very important piece because, as you can hear politically, a lot of different discussions around going into other technologies or land base. And we feel that this is probably the strongest way to produce healthy salmon while achieving those goals, sustainable goals, in a cost-effective manner.
And do you see the market for the product here? I mean, is it a local market? Is it an export market? It does seem to be a product that's almost at a premium, right? It's very healthy. It's, you know, in it, produced or farmed in a very sustainable fashion. Is there an opportunity to sort of elevate the cost and identify in a very niche market?
I think so. You know, from what I understand, you know, especially when you look locally here, you know, a lot of people are asking for this as a product. They want to see something different. They want some different choices other than the traditional style farming versus, you know, wild. And being that sustainable, you see this around the world. People are putting the pressure on farmers to increase that bar all the time. And, you know, I think that's very important. And I think that we also, again, have to make sure as we talk about, you know, the changes in the aquaculture program now, and maybe new regulations will come up with different thresholds. It's so very important that those thresholds are picked on actual environmental parameters. We need to make sure that when we make those changes, it's relevant to improvement. You know, we need to keep that full picture in mind. You know, right now there's a lot of criticism around wild salmon. And I think people would be surprised to hear that when we actually look at the numbers of wild salmon in the Pacific Ocean right now, we have the highest number of wild salmon than there's ever been on record of us reporting salmon in the ocean. It's phenomenal. There are a lot of wild salmon in the Pacific Ocean. In fact, so much that is interesting in the, I was in a discussion a few months ago with my colleagues in Norway. They actually have over 2 million invasive pink salmon in their river systems now. So there's so many Pacific salmon, they found their way into the Atlantic Ocean. And that's a challenge because that's like 400-500% more than their own native salmon. So it's become a challenge for them. So we need to understand that bigger picture, you know, and then we also need to, I think it's very important that we when we do the science by reputable scientists, I mean, there's so many talented women and men that work in the Department of Fisheries Ocean with that data and science that they've done and use third-party consultant scientists, then we need to actually use that, because it is credible science. And I think it's important that that becomes a foundational point for making improvements and changes into the future.
You taught bigger picture, and I'm 100%. I think we sometimes lose the forest from the trees. Yeah, that's the right way around. Lose the forest from the trees concept, because, you know, aquaculture is going to happen. We need the protein. We need the fish. You've probably got the statistics on how much aquaculture we need for the world, but we need food, right? That's not a given. And it's the better, more sustainable way of doing it. And as long as we're sort of keeping an eye on that bigger picture, and anything we do is going to have an impact, but how do we sort of measure that impact better? So the reason I bring that up is you've been in the industry for 30 years. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you've seen in the last 30 years, and probably more so over the last 5 or 10 years, that, you know, need to be dispelled for us to really progress?
Yeah, it is. I think in that 30 years, I mean, there's been moratoriums on the industry. It has been a pernicious environment, meaning that, you know, where it could have been promoted in a healthy way, it's really kept in this sort of low, let's not take any risks. And I think the challenge becomes, I mean, if we, you know, we have to look, I think right now, when I see this comparison, or we're our horses hitched to the wagon of wild salmon, we need to really understand what's going on with wild salmon. First of all, we need to understand, I mean, what we call wild salmon in BC is, you know, there are hundreds of millions of enhanced salmon, you know, and that's not done everywhere in the world. If you go to Norway, they don't do enhancement projects. So they're always looking at what is naturally wild. Here we get involved. There's a level of involvement. So you see enhanced salmon in a way that they're released to out into the Pacific Basin, and that has an impact. So we have to have that discussion as part of it, because fully understanding how that works and what that impact is, and then understanding what aquaculture is and that impact. And then bring in the third layer, which is the salmon ranching that you see happening. And that is really the giant of all the industries, as, you know, compared to us doing, you know, 40 million salmon in BC a year, they're doing over 7 billion ranch salmon, which are, again, they're using the similar technologies. They're all fed in a hatchery. They're all vaccinated. They're then even transferred into net pens after a year in the hatchery systems. And then at some point, they're released into the wild. So that has an impact too. And even though they're branded and caught and called wild salmon, that is a form of farming, except for you don't really have the control of that impact, what happens out in the Pacific Basin. So I think all of those discussions need to be brought together so that we really understand what that is. Obviously, you know, I've done this a long time, and I truly believe what we're doing is a very sustainable way, farming in the ocean, because we have control over where the food comes from, where the fish are, you know, and, you know, it's not to say we're perfect with the way we are, and we still need to continue to work on always these improvements, but based on improvements that are legitimate, you know, obviously any kind of impact threats. There is always going to be an impact in everything we do. In the environment, you build a nature trail, there's going to be an impact. But, you know, we want to make sure that we're continually working at improving that. And then that has to be spread across all farming practices, both in aquaculture and terrestrial. So, you know, where I see sometimes us, we get stuck in moving in a positive direction faster, because I think we need to be really, as a whole discussion, bringing salmon in under one big discussion and finding the best way to do salmon as a whole.
And I think it's a wonderful sentiment. And I think that's what Aquifer Future is doing. And from my limited exposure to it, it's really pushing that envelope on innovation, trying to make sure it's sustainable, minimizing the impact. And I think it's a great operation, and I wish you the best successes.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. And we're excited. I mean, again, it's being able to use technology and where there are these perceived risks, is then, you know, take those off the table. Let's keep moving forward to get that trust and that confidence, so that we can grow the aquaculture industry as a whole globally bigger.
Thanks, Dean. I'm going to wrap it up there. We're almost out of time. Appreciate your time. I know it's valuable, and it's great to get those insights from someone with your level of experience, and appreciate you coming on today.
This is my pleasure. Thank you so much, Jason.
That concludes our podcast today. Thank you for listening. As always, please visit our website at canadacoast.ca, where this podcast will be posted. And thank you, and we'll talk to you next time.